wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission, we run the crowd loud. This pumping rhythm is hitting, we wanna make it clear, we ain't scared, this is the vision we want, we want, we want. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, we address global capitalism and permanent war. Our guests include William Robinson, professor of sociology at University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity. We'll also be joined by Kathy Kelly with Voices for Creative Nonviolence for her work to end U.S. military and economic warfare. We hope you'll stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today we address global capitalism and permanent war. Our guests include William Robinson, a professor of sociology at UC Santa Barbara, and author of Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity. Later in the show, we'll speak with Kathy Kelly, Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Here is Peter to introduce our first guest today. Peter?
William Robinson is a professor of sociology, global and international studies, and Latin American studies at the University of California in Santa Barbara. Among his many books are The Transnational Conflict from 2003, A Theory of Global Capitalism in 2004, Latin America and Global Capitalism in 2008, and his newest book, Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity, which just came out in 2014 and which I'm currently using in my political sociology class. So thank you very much, William Robinson.
Pleasure to be on the program.
You talk about the new concepts in sociology, transnational capitalist class and transnational state. Could you explain those a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. I've been suggesting that we're in a qualitatively new phase or new epoch in the ongoing and always the open-ended evolution of world capitalism. And there's some defining features, novel features of this new stage of world capitalism. I mean, the system has been around for the last 500 years, but in the late 20th century to early 21st century, we move into this new epoch of globalized capitalism that's defined, first of all, by the rise of truly transnational capital. And we've seen every country in the world integrated into a new globalized production and financial system. So that's the first, the idea of transnational capital and a fully globalized and globally integrated economy. And who are the manifest agents of this globalized economy? Well, that's the appearance of this new transnational capitalist class. And what sets apart transnational capitalists from national or regional capitalists is this is a class group which is grounded in these new globalized circuits of accumulation rather than in national circuits. So they identify, that is, the transnational capitalist class identifies more with the global economy as a whole than with particular national or regional economies. And I've been researching this for the last 20 years. Not just myself. And what we see is that the giant global corporations are interpenetrated with each other across borders and all around the world in numerous ways. So that changes basically the nature of the capitalist system, the capitalist class, and its agents worldwide. And let me clarify that there are still local capitalists, there are still national capitalists and regional capitalists. But the idea here is that the transnational capitalist class, or that fraction of capital, is truly hegemonic. It's dominant. It controls the global economy. Then the third thing that we've seen truly novel with regard to world capitalism in the last few decades is the rise of what I refer to as transnational state apparatuses. And here I do not mean that there is a global government. There is not, and there may never be a global government. But rather, we've seen that each national state, such as the U.S. state, the Mexican state, the South African state, and so forth, has been increasingly penetrated and captured by transnational capitalists and transnationally oriented elites. And they've utilized national states to globalize each country in the world, to push forward global free trade agreements, to lift barriers to the free movement of capital around the world. And they've done this, each of the national states, as they've been captured by transnationally oriented elites. They've done this in conjunction with a whole series of existing and new super and transnational organizations. organizations. Among them, listeners are certainly familiar with the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, but there's many, many more. And, of course, all these free trade agreements, including the TPP. And also, I'll just conclude this aspect, that the transnational capitalist class attempts to exercise its class power, its domination, and push forward its interests through this dense network that I'm calling transnational state apparatuses. Finally, there's a fourth dimension which is new to the late 20th, early 21st century, and that is we're seeing novel relations of inequality and domination in global society. Of course, inequality has been around for millennia, and domination is inherent to class societies, but we're seeing new ways in which inequality and domination and hegemony is exercised in global society. And of course, if we want to fight that domination and that inequality, we really need to understand the nature of the new nature of global capitalism.
Professor William Robinson, let's talk about you. You hit on many, many points there. We do want to come back and talk about some of these so-called free trade agreements. But let's talk about this. You had a recent article at Global Research. The world capital system is arguably experiencing the worst crisis in its 500-year history. And you begin by talking about a system-wide crisis we face from the 1930s or the 1970s. Could you walk us through briefly, of course, give us some background historically here of how we get up through to the present and describe this current crisis, and then we can talk more about opportunities and what to do about that as we move along.
Absolutely. I'll do this quickly and as synthetically as possible. The capitalist system is in a totally contradictory and it's a crisis-ridden system. And we generally identify three types of crises. There are cyclical crises, that's recessions every 10 years. We see it almost like clockwork. There was a recession in the early 1980s, the early 1990s, the 2000-2001. And those crises usually play out for 12 to 16 months and then the system corrects itself. Many people suffer, of course. That's why it's crisis. Then we see something more deeper, which is called structural crises. And we see them about once every 40 to 50 years. And so we saw a big crisis, big structural crisis in the late 1800s, then again in the 1930s, the Great Depression. The next big structural crisis was the 1970s. That structural crisis of the 1970s led us to capitalist globalization because capital went global in response to that structural crisis. And now we are in another structural crisis. And for the listeners, what I mean by a structural crisis is the only way to get out of the crisis is by to thoroughly restructure the capitalist system, the way it's organized, its institutions, and so forth. There's also a third kind of crisis called a systemic crisis, and that means a crisis is so grave that the only way to resolve the crisis is to have a totally system change. And we might be headed towards a system crisis, meaning we would have to move beyond capitalism in order to resolve this crisis of humanity, hence, of course, the title of my book. But the last great crisis was the 1970s, and this one, which we have in the 21st century, which really explodes in 2008, is for me simply unprecedented. It can't even be compared to earlier structural crises because the very existence of humanity, and for that matter, life on the planet is at stake. And I'll go very briefly with this. I think there are six things that set this crisis apart from earlier ones. The first is everyone knows we're reaching the ecological limits of the reproduction of the capitalist system. We've reached these several tipping points. Scientists tell us that climate change, nitrogen cycle, diversity loss is already beyond repair. And a recent book came out, which many of you listeners would be familiar with, referring to the sixth mass extinction. There have been five previous extinctions on the planet in its 5 billion year history, and they were due to natural causes. This one would be due to human intervention. So we can't underestimate this dimension, the ecological dimensions of the 21st century crisis. The second dimension, which sets this apart from all earlier crises, is the sheer magnitude of the means of violence and of social control, and those means of violence and social control in the hands of very small groups who are extremely dangerous and have shown that they are using those means of violence. And as well, the means of global communication and the production and circulation of symbols and images are ever more concentrated and means new forms of hegemony are being exercised. You know, Snowden came out with his revelations a year or so ago, and really the world of Edward Snowden is the world of George Orwell, but with the exception that it's worse, because George Orwell wrote his famous book, 1984, in which everyone had to give their obedience to the system, but in exchange they had guaranteed employment, guaranteed health, guaranteed housing. They could have a healthy, normal life apart from being totally subordinated to the system and its dictates. But here in this world of Edward Snowden or 1984, fast-forwarding, we are compelled by force to give our obedience to the system, but we are denied our very means of existence, housing, healthcare, food, and so forth. The third thing, which really sets this crisis apart from any other earlier ones, is the extent of inequality. We have never seen this. Again, inequality has been around for millennia. Inequality under capitalism is endemic. But we've never seen the unbelievable extent of social inequalities worldwide that we're seeing today. I have some data in front of me. I'm not going to read it for lack of time, but we can certainly come back to it. But it boggles the mind, the levels of inequality. The fourth thing that makes this crisis so unique is we're seeing the limits to the expansion of capitalism. What I mean by this is that capitalism is a system like a bicycle. If you ride a bicycle, you have to keep on pedaling to move it forward. If you stop pedaling, the bicycle crashes over. And if capitalism stops expanding outward, it crashes. It comes to a total collapse. And the question is, where now can capitalism expand? It's engulfed the entire planet. There's no more new zones, new territories around the world to incorporate into world capitalism. So that is something new. Yet a fifth thing, which is new, again, I was saying there's six things about this crisis which set it apart from all earlier crises and makes it truly a crisis of humanity. The fifth thing is that we're seeing the rise of a vast surplus population inhabiting, to quote Mike Davis, a planet of slums. This is one-third of humanity has been thrown out of the productive economy, thrown into the margins, and then are subject to sophisticated systems of social control, to state violence and policing, and to destruction, to what I refer to as a mortal cycle of dispossession, exploitation, and exclusion. Now, there have always been this portion of the population which is marginalized from society, and of course, all of this is very racialized from one society to another. But this surplus humanity, we've never seen one-third or more of humanity simply locked out and then subject to very sophisticated systems of social control and, in some cases, to outright genocide. So the principal challenge facing the dominant groups around the world, the transnational capitalist class, is how do you control the real and the potential rebellion of this mass of humanity which has been thrown into the margins and tightly controlled? And if you want to apply this to a particular country, again, this is all over the world, but you want to know why there's this incredible, just ongoing escalation of police blatant murder everywhere, you know, we go, of African Americans and Latinos and people in general, and ever heightens policing. It's because you have to control the population locked out of participation in society. Then finally, because I'm saying there are six things about this crisis which makes it unique, the final thing which we want to look at is there is this disjuncture. And this is a bit academic, but very important to understand. Between a globalizing economy, the economy is ever more globalized and globally integrated, and on the other hand, a nation-state-based system of political authority, meaning that decisions are made and political authority is exercised at the level of 200 individual nation-states. So that's a contradiction. Transnational state apparatuses that I mentioned, they're incipient. They have not been able to organize and stabilize the systems. In other words, elites themselves do not see how they can have the political instruments to stabilize the system, to overcome its anarchic tendencies. And so there's no clear way out. So that, in a nutshell, I know that's a lot, but that, I think, would be the outlines of this crisis of humanity we're facing in the 21st century.
We're speaking with William Robinson, professor of sociology at UC Santa Barbara, author of Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity. We'll be right back to continue that conversation after this musical break. Stay with us.
Yeah!
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today we're discussing global capitalism and permanent war, and our guest right now is Professor William Robinson. He is a sociology professor at UC Santa Barbara in California, author of Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity. Peter?
William, I'm going to try to briefly summarize what you said. It's quite significant, I think, in that we have a crisis in humanity. And by that, you mean that global capitalism has expanded, it kind of reached limits. There's ecological limits in terms of species extinction, including our own. There is massive violence and social control perpetrated by nation states in cooperation with global capital and capitalism. And this is increasing an intensified planet of slums and poor people, billions of people living on a couple dollars a day. And they inevitably will resist. So the transnational capitalist class is prepared and expanded a police state worldwide to repress this kind of uprising, which inevitably will happen as they face an economic collapse due to the inability to continue to expand and grow capital.
Yes, that's an excellent summary.
You use the term a degeneration into a new dark age. Do you think that's inevitable, or what kind of resistance can change this?
No, I mean, nothing is inevitable. Collapse is close, but absolutely nothing's inevitable. The future is not predetermined. You know, what I see going on around the world currently is a polarization between a resurgent populist struggles, leftist struggles, and anti-capitalist alternatives on the one hand, and on the other hand, I see a resurgent of far-right neo-fascist or 21st century fascist forces. And it's not clear which of these responses to the global crisis is going to get the upper hand. And at the same time, there's also what I refer to as the reformist wing of the transnational elite, which is acknowledging that the incredible inequalities, as well as the extent of ecological holocaust, is so serious that it even affects the interests of the global capital system and of transnational elites. And so that's sort of a third response to this crisis has been this reformist elite, but they've been quite ineffectual and haven't come up with very serious proposals. I mean, they talk about a green capitalism to resolve the ecological contradictions, and they are enamored with Thomas Piketty's book because it exposes the extent to and the dangers of this incredible global inequality. So I think there are those three responses, and it's going to depend on how things play themselves out in the next few years. And, you know, I would just add one thing also. If you analyze why the collapse of 2008 took place, it's very easy to see what happened. It's already been done. Many people have done it. But the conditions which brought about that collapse are still very much present and have even gotten worse. So I think it's almost inevitable there's going to be another major financial economic collapse, maybe 6 months from now, maybe a couple years from now. But that's what we're headed towards. And, you know, it's in those times of crisis where things are very, very unpredictable and where different social and political forces, including leftist forces, popular forces from below, can take the initiative.
You're writing also about financial speculation in that transnational capital is engaged in these massive speculative investments, driving prices up in land and commodities and anything else where there can be a return. And the inevitability of that collapsing, like the banking systems collapsing, and all we did was throw trillions of dollars to the banks to sort of temporarily bail them out, but that hasn't fixed the problem. Is that correct?
Absolutely, completely. I mean, you know, what happened here is because inequality is so severe, and I just mention one thing. Oxfam released a report in January to coincide with the last meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, and they reported that the richest 1% on the planet now own more than the rest of the world, And so as a result, you know, you have this incredible expansion of the global economy leading up to 2008, but the world's population can't consume everything coming out of the global farm, the global factory, all of this wealth. So it can't be absorbed. The world market cannot absorb all of this output. So the transnational elite and transnational capitalists turned to two big mechanisms to try and continue making profits in the face of the inability of people to consume around the world. And one is financial speculation, one of those two mechanisms. And the amounts being speculated is just simply boggles the mind. Currently, the global bond market is above $100 trillion. $1 trillion. And every 2 or 3 days, derivative trading, and you know derivatives don't represent anything real, it's simply financial speculation. Derivative trading in a few days amounts to more than the entire world's output of a year of the real global economy. So this financial speculation is so just, again, just boggles the mind. And you're saying so the banks got these bailouts after 2008, but what did they do with those bailouts? They simply recycled them into new rounds of speculative activity. So financial speculation, which has nothing to do with the real economy of people's, well, they do, because they affect us all, has actually gotten worse, intensified in new ways between 2008 and 2015. And then I mentioned the other mechanism, the transnational elites, the capitalists, since 2008, really since 2001, use these two mechanisms to continue making profit in the face of the crisis. The other is what I call militarized accumulation, meaning that the more wars there are, the more prison industrial complexes there are, the more immigrant detention centers there are, the more militarized borders, such as in Israel and green zones and U.S.-Mexico border, the more that is, the more profit can be made. And so militarized accumulation and making wars and making conflicts is actually a way of making profit in the face of economic stagnation. It's absolutely bizarre, but that's the world of global capitalism that we live in. Permanent warfare.
Professor William Robinson, I couldn't help but think of Smedley Butler from the 1930s, certainly a smaller global economy, but certainly one where we see an admission of using nation states, populations, and war machinery to secure capital around the world. And we have, of course, other mechanisms. Military is a huge one. And our guest later in the program, Kathy Kelly, is going to talk more about that. But I wanted to come back to one issue we zoomed over, and that was these so-called free trade agreements. And of course, folks that are paying attention now have heard of TPP, or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, incredibly secretive trade deal, as it's referred to. What can you tell us about this? And again, why are people concerned about it that have been following, at least what they can know about it?
All of these free trade agreements, starting with the creation of the World Trade Organization and the North American Free Trade Agreement, have given free rein to transnational capital to basically do whatever it wants and impose its own power over populations in each country and the power that they could exercise through their own nation state and their own democratic processes and political system. But this really takes it to a whole new level. Each of these trade agreements have eroded more and more the power of publics, of working classes, of popular classes all around the world, and the ability of individual nation states to respond to the needs of those popular classes. It's eroded the rights, the legal rights, the regulatory structures of nation states to put some curbs on the rapacious activity of these global capitalists. But when you get to the TPP, it removes like any last barriers that were left. It just gives a total, literally, a dictatorship to transnational capital. And you know, remember, the term dictatorship comes from the word dictate, meaning transnational capital can dictate how global society is going to function, what's going to happen day in and day out. So people are very justifiably, you know, unbelievably alarmed by the TPP. It even allows global corporations, if a country says, wait, we're not going to allow this investment here because it's a mining operation which is going to dump arsenic into the rivers and poison whole communities, so please do not invest here, we're not going to let you. Let's say a particular government says that. The corporation, according to the TPP, can then sue the government for future profits that it would have earned if it were allowed to make that investment, and then go ahead and make the investment anyway. I mean, it's literally a dictatorship of transnational capital. And by the way, the example I just gave of blocking a mining company because it would poison rivers and communities from making an investment is a real case of El Salvador. El Salvador has this in the courts right now because the Central American Free Trade Agreement actually allows corporations to sue governments if the government affects the ability of any corporation to make future profits, even when it hasn't invested. But the TPP would extend that all around the world, to all five continents. I mean, it takes this to a maximum, and again, an absolute dictatorship of transnational capital over the world's population.
As you explain that, I think of many things. And one of these, not only is a global police state and trade agreements being done in secret, the idea of a militarized capitalism, meaning not only are these NATO and U.S. military, but you talk about G4S in your book as one of the international security companies operating in 125 countries, 600,000 people, with components that are capable of warfare. So this idea that major corporations and capital can hire armies goes back to feudalism. That goes back when kings would hire mercenaries to attack their neighbors. And essentially, we're talking about privatized military operation. This isn't just Blackwater. I mean, there's companies all over the world that do this. Is that one of your concerns?
Absolutely. You know, you were commenting on Smedley Butler and his famous quote in the 1930s that he was a big muscle man for Wall Street. And so it's true. What we've seen, you know, over the last few hundred years, of course, is that states use the militaries to protect and open up areas for capital. That part is continuing. But what we have not seen yet, and what you're commenting on, is that now any conflict, any war, any forms of repression and of social control themselves are simply undertaken in order to make profit for that simple reason, even if there's not a particular geopolitical objective. And absolutely, we're living in a private homeland security global economy, a permanent war economy. And the example that some of your listeners might be aware of, but others might not be aware of, is, you know, there's this incredibly racist and fascist series of laws that have been passed in the United States, the anti-immigrant laws, starting with the Arizona law several years ago. And what listeners might not be aware of is that that law came out of ALEC. ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Committee, which represents 500 biggest global corporations, and they meet with state-level elected officials several times a year, and the corporations finance the campaigns of these elected officials. In exchange, the corporations draw up draft legislation that they hand to the elected officials and say, go back to your states and pass this legislation. And the Arizona anti-immigrant law, and then a whole slew of other ones that followed elsewhere around the United States, was actually drafted by the Corrections Corporation of America and by GEO Group, which are the two largest private for-profit prison companies. They build private immigrant detention centers, and every time there's an immigrant arrested, they get $112 per night for keeping that immigrant locked up. So it was GEO Group and it was Corrections Corporation of America in ALEC, in that organization, that drafted the Arizona law, handed it to Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, and several other officials who happened also to be shareholders in Corrections Corporation of America, and they passed that law. And so, I mean, here you have a situation where private interests, there's this totally private corporations simply want to develop social control systems, anti-immigrant systems, prisons, simply to make profit, independent of ideology, independent of any political considerations. And you can see this total fusion of public-private interests and domination of private capital over public government in function of making profit through social control, through repression, through militarization. So that's the global situation, really, if you start studying this all around the world.
William Robinson, you conclude your recent article by saying that we have been witnessing transitions from social welfare to social control states around the world. We have entered a period of great upheavals, momentous changes, and uncertainties. The only viable solution to the crisis of global capitalism is a massive redistribution of wealth and power downward towards the poor majority of humanity, along the lines of a 21st century democratic socialism in which humanity is no longer at war with itself and with nature. Certainly a good note to end on. William Robinson, your professor of sociology, global international studies, and Latin American studies at University of California, Santa Barbara. Your new book is Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity. People can learn more if they do a web search on you by looking at William Robinson. William Robinson, thank you so much for taking time to join us today about this very important topic.
It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll continue our theme on global capitalism and permanent war with the coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, Kathy Kelly, after this break. Stay with us.
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffers, man, this ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The U.S. government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid bumping music that's abusive to the shorties. And the nonsense that they're spitting, they just listening and absorbing. I've been dormant, I've been working. walking, I'm a giant, I'm ready. I'm with the Apu and Oaxaca, and we hold the machetes. I rock hard like palace kidding, children holding slingshots. I'm with every single kid that's down for hip hop, for the culture, the life, what it really stands for. This music is resistance, it's the voice of the poor. I'm on the side of the workers, the teachers, and lunch ladies. On the streets with brown mommies, raising our brown babies. I'm with youth organizers, cleaning up the Bronx River. I'm like Jaime Escalante when I stand and deliver. I'm with Evo Morales, man, he running Bolivia. Distribution of the land so we can all live bigger. I'm with Hugo and Fidel, Grandmaster Ramelli Mel. I'm with the Panthers up in Queens, justice for Sean Bell. I'm with Camacho Negron, I'm with Ojeda Rios. Freedom for Oscar López, it's time to get an appeal. I'm with Abu Jamal, I'm with Asada Shakur. I'm with the compas in the market, he getting a penny more. Telling the truth, exposing the lies. Think about the dead soldiers when you drive and you ride. The people die for the war, and Daddy Bush's revenge. I'm with the widows, the children, and the lonely best friends. I'm for families staying together as one. I'm not for the raids and the deportations. I'm with Victor Toro and the MIR. So watch out for them snitches in their unmarked car. And for Lil Saulito, we gon' fight for your moms. So we gon' shout her out twice in one song. I'm for 12 million workers and then Vida.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We continue our theme on global capitalism and permanent war for the remainder of the program with our guest, Kathy Kelly. And here is Peter to give a proper introduction. Peter?
Kathy Kelly coordinates Voices for Creative Nonviolence, a campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare. During each of 14 trips to Afghanistan, she stayed in neighborhoods with the people. She and her companions insist that the U.S. has not been waging humanitarian war in Afghanistan and Iraq, but the U.S. should pay reparations for the suffering caused there in our wars since 9/11. Kathy, you were released from serving 3 months' sentence in a federal prison for attempting to deliver a loaf of bread and a letter to the commander of Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri. That's not the first time you've been in prison. So can you tell us about that incident, and what are your plans now?
The first time that I was ever put in a federal prison was in Lexington, Kentucky, where I just was released 2 days ago. So this has been a long span in my own life. I was locked up there in a maximum security prison for women in 1989 when a number of us had planted corn on top of nuclear missile silo sites, and I was sentenced to a year in prison that time. And this time it was a 3-month sentence. But, you know, when you speak about permanent war, I think we've concurrently had a war against the poor going on in the United States with an incredible spike in mass incarceration of people, many times disproportionately representing people of color in neighborhoods that have been among the most neglected, the most underserved. And part of that reason is because the military has been hogging our resources consistently over all of these years. And we now face a prison industrial complex and a military industrial complex. And I think it's important to stand up and say, look, this is what we've seen and heard when a number of us have had an opportunity to go to a war zone and sit with ordinary people and find out from them, has this improved your lives? Have you become safer? Is there some rhyme or reason that you see to continuing the warfare in your area? And what we've heard overwhelmingly is a rejection of continued warfare.
Kathy, can you talk a little bit about drones and the impact that's having in the world?
The usage of a combination of drone surveillance and special operations forces means that in the future, the United States perhaps won't be as dependent on sprawling military bases or many thousands of troops stationed in an area, and instead would be dependent on surveillance to gain intelligence about where possible targets for assassination might be living or might be moving about. And very often, the person targeted for assassination is living with a family or moving about on a roadside or inside of a mosque or a restaurant, and civilians are killed as well. And sometimes the person targeted for assassination turns out to have been killed as many as 7 times, according to the numbers of efforts to try to assassinate a given individual. And there have been many instances in which drones have been fired at convoys that are means of transport for civilians with no relationship to any kind of terrorist activity at all. So it's caused a great deal of resentment toward the United States. And I think of a proliferation of drones now is something that the public has to come to grips with and should be discussing and should be seeking accountability. But as weapon-making companies find new and ever-increasing ways to use drones in warfare, I think we'll find robotics becoming a mark of the new kinds of warfare the United States will pursue, and then other countries will pursue it as well. So we're very much opposed to drone warfare, and many of the Air National Guard bases across the United States are now being used mm-hmm. to operate drones over other countries. So we've been going to some of those military bases or Air National Guard bases and trying to talk with the commanders and ask questions. How many people were killed by drones today that your base was operating, and how do you help the operators distinguish between civilians and military people? And what if some of your operators don't want to any longer be involved in this kind of warfare? What can they do?
Kathy Kelly, just to give our listeners maybe a broader data picture about also what motivates you to protest these drone strikes, this policy that's been embraced by the Obama administration. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism out of London has a pretty detailed database by country reporting deaths and injuries from drone strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan. I mean, the numbers are actually staggering. I'm not going to list all of them, but I wanted to just list a few of them. People can learn more at thebureauinvestigates.com. In Pakistan, total strikes are over 400. Total killed is anywhere between 2,500 and 4,000, upwards of 1,000 civilians and 200 children, between 1,000 and 2,000 injured. The numbers are similar in places. If you add Yemen and Somalia to the mix with Afghanistan, they begin to rival the number in Pakistan. And just recently, we learned of an American and Italian hostage killed from January in a CIA drone strike in Pakistan. So talk maybe a little bit about some of the specifics regarding these things. Give people a little understanding about why you think this is so problematic.
Well, for instance, the CIA was using Creature Force Base and United States military personnel to carry out its assassination program, and there's no accountability. The CIA isn't required to give an accounting to the U.S. public about what kinds of drone attacks they've been authorizing. And sometimes in areas of Afghanistan, when people are aware that some kind of intelligence seems to have been given to somebody such that an attack will be waged, then the people living in the area become very, very frightened. They hear drones flying overhead, or they are near a place where a drone attack happens, and they'll pick up and run in their panic because they're afraid that they'll be accused of being the ones who might have been consorting with some kind of enemy forces. And so it's also produced a situation in Afghanistan wherein 400 people were displaced by warfare every single day, according to an Amnesty International report. Now, that was issued in 2012. But if you can imagine these sprawling, wretched refugee camps, which are also a consequence of the airborne attacks, the night raids, and the fear and anger that gets sown into small towns and villages as the consequences of the war are played out. Well, in the refugee camps, people can't find jobs and they can't feed their children. They send their children out to work on the streets. And the list just goes on and on and on of awful, terrible circumstances caused by exacerbating and prolonging the warfare. And we believe that the drone usage makes it more tempting for militarists to say, well, our soldiers aren't going to be damaged because they're not even there. We've just got this unmanned aerial vehicle flying overhead. So it can easily prolong and exacerbate warfare.
The U.S.-NATO military empire justifies this kind of activity, drone warfare, various interventions worldwide, as fighting terrorism to protect us, so to speak. Is there any such thing as a humanitarian war?
No, I think that's a very pernicious idea. You know, I think that when there's an effort to kind of market or sell a war to the U.S. public, it's been successful in the past if you can convince the U.S. public to be uncertain, just to be uncertain enough that they're not going to take a stand, a strong stand of opposition, because of the suggestion that maybe they would be abandoning people who need the war to be continued. And so people thought, well, we have to get rid of Saddam Hussein. He's a terrible, brutal dictator, so we're doing a good thing if we go to war in Iraq. And in Afghanistan, I think there was kind of a fuzzy notion that we had to save women and children from the Taliban. But as it turns out, the possibility of negotiating with the Taliban might have existed, and General Petraeus and his counterintelligence efforts wanted to continue warfare because he thought he'd be able to weaken the positions of the Taliban. The idea that people benefit from or are saved by warfare is, I think, something that wouldn't work very well if the shoe were on the other foot and if we thought that some other country was waging war on our soil to protect us. I don't think the United States people would go along with that for very long.
Well, Kathy Kelly, two things sprang to mind very quickly when you were talking about the lack of diplomacy with the Taliban in Afghanistan in the Bush administration when asking for evidence about Osama bin Laden's alleged involvement in the 9/11 attacks. The Bush administration responded by saying they didn't need any evidence. And later, of course, the U.S. military was ordered to let him escape through Tora Bora. We're not going to open up that can of worms right now, but the point is, as you were illustrating, is that this is framed as some kind of humanitarian endeavor, and the Marines were feminists saving the women. We, of course, know from the Revolutionary Women of Afghanistan, Rawa, and others that, you know, that's not the case, and situations in these countries have actually worsened since U.S. Warfare and occupation. And I think that's another reason why you're pointing out that there's no such thing as a humanitarian war. We're speaking with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You can learn more at www.vcnv.org. We'll continue with our conversation with Kathy Kelly after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We're continuing our theme on global capitalism and permanent war. We're speaking with Kathy Kelly, who is co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She's on a West Coast tour right now, speaking about her protesting of drone strikes. She's recently been released from federal prison. Kathy Kelly, you know, you have a history of civil disobedience as a means to push for change, including you're a war tax refuser and have refused to pay taxes since 1980. Can you talk to us a little bit about your civil disobedience and why you've chosen this path?
Well, I suppose in a way I could say that the IRS has been my spiritual director. If you decide that you're not going to pay taxes, you have to really know that you'll never pay. Otherwise, if the IRS eventually begins to collect, they'll collect penalties and interest and might take more money than was ever owed to them in the first place. But there is a community of people across the United States who, either by lowering salaries beneath the taxable income, by choosing to live very simply, have been successful in refusing all forms of federal income tax. Since 1980, I've been among such a group, and I think it's important for us to recognize that in many ways the United States government hasn't been very interested in our consent or our approval for various wars for United States militarism. They've just wanted the money. And the United States people, in having to meet what the Pentagon, which is almost insatiable in its insistence on taking more and more of our resources, and not only our money, our ingenuity, our inventiveness, our abilities to solve problems, it gets commandeered by the Pentagon. And so what's left? Well, we've got crumbling infrastructure. We're not able to handle the very real terrors we face in terms of climate change and global warming and being able to adapt our lifestyles so that we can have a more sensible way to go forward. And we're certainly not able to give an adequate education or often even health care or create meaningful jobs in some of the poorest neighborhoods across the United States. And so that has spawned the prison industrial complex. And certainly for me to go and live amongst women who are trapped inside of a prison was to live in a world of imprisoned beauty. I don't know where they keep the bad sisters. I've been locked up in maximum security, minimum security. I don't meet women that are frightening or even intimidating in the slightest or even annoying. And yet this punishment that breaks apart families and makes it even all the more likely that the military can be a predator in the poorest of neighborhoods and, you know, snatch young people up into military structures. It goes on and on. So I think this is a reality that we need to face. And I hope that the Black Lives Matter campaign, I hope that the campaigns that have arisen around some very important books, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, Bryan Stevenson's Just Mercies, will help people become better educated and better aware about the reality we live in, a world that's fraught with our military-industrial complex and our prison-industrial complex.
Kathy Kelly, you travel around the country, around the world, addressing these issues and encouraging people to do what they can to oppose this global war and repression in our own country, a repression, the use of the criminal justice system, as well as the massive expenditures on the military, really to protect the 1%. So for people who are concerned about these issues, on a daily basis, what do you tell people to do? Education certainly was one aspect of that. So reading, communicating, how do you engage? I mean, do you tell people not to pay their income tax?
Truthfully, no. You have to really know that there's water in the pool before you dive into that pool and be ready to say, I'll never, ever pay this tax. And there are not so many people, quite honestly, who can do that. But can people withdraw their consent and find other ways to kind of get yourself a gang, as Kurt Vonnegut liked to put it, and find a grassroots group that they'll work with in building local grassroots initiatives and finding ways to expand affinities with other groups that are also wanting to seek social change? I think that's one important thing. I find that the Afghan Peace Volunteers, this group that I've been able to visit since 2010 in Afghanistan, is a group that actually gives a great deal of encouragement to other people. When I first met them, they were teenagers. They're getting older now. And they've been trapped in a war zone, and they've refused to let this dominate their lives. They want to break beyond the patterns of war, and so they've set themselves up with a campaign that they call Border Free, a Border Free Center, and they invite the kids who are worse off than them, the ones who are street children, who are forced by their parents to go out and labor because there's no other possible source of income. They're living in refugee camps, or sometimes the moms are widows. And these young ones I'm speaking of have kind of created an alternative school for the street children, and they provide the mothers and the unemployed fathers with rice and oil as a compensation if they take the kids out of the streets and get them into the schools. And they've been giving them rudimentary lessons in Dari and math. Dari is the language spoken in Afghanistan. So I encourage people to visit that website. It's called OurJourneyToSmile.com, and to get to know one small project being done by some very inspirational teenagers, and feel encouraged by that. And then ask ourselves, you know, what can we do locally in our area that will help to give our neighbors, give maybe people within our faith-based community, give educators or give community leaders a chance to stand up to the U.S. militarism and the ways in which the U.S. military has been dominating our lives in often patterns that have terrible consequences for people, especially as our schools become more and more militarized.
Kathy Kelly, if we were able to cut the military budget by 90%, let's say, and we had several hundred billion dollars. You talk about reparations for Afghanistan and Iraq. What would that entail?
Well, you know, I remember a young 13-year-old on the phone with Noam Chomsky, and he said, "Prof. Noam, what do you think about reparations?" And Professor Chomsky was clearly very taken by this child's question, and he said, "Oh, any civilized country would pay reparations for what's been done in a place like Afghanistan, where not only the United States, but also other countries have just littered that landscape with their weapons and their various materials of invasion." I think the United States should entrust reparations, but not be the ones assigned to administer such payment. I mean, the ways in which billions and billions of dollars have been fraudulently spent in Afghanistan under the administration of United States programs has been laid out very, very clearly by the Special Inspector General in Afghanistan reports. And I think the United States can't be trusted with the efforts to administer reparations. But certainly the United States should be required to pay reparation for the suffering caused.
Kathy Kelly, speaking of reparations, one sort of step along the way to reparations is acknowledgement of wrongdoing, even if it's something that wasn't quote-unquote illegal at the time of its occurrence because of warped legal justifications. President Obama just recently apologized for the deaths of innocent hostages in the U.S. drone strike. Of course, also one of the more notorious deaths was the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki's 16-year-old son, an American citizen. Obama says here, quote, "I profoundly regret what happened," end quote. But the people at the Center for Constitutional Rights, I think, very aptly pointed out and added, how about taking responsibility for the thousands of unnamed others, including hundreds of children killed and injured by U.S. drones? How about real transparency for the program and accountability for all civilian harm? How about a judicial check on the executive's claimed power to fire missiles on people outside of battlefields? I mean, including we've seen in places like Afghanistan, especially, where we're bombing wedding parties. This obviously is something that you are attuned to and a reason that you certainly oppose these strikes. But even acknowledging it happens, now that we have this brief little sliver of a door open with an Obama apology, could we be pushing and demanding a full review of this kind of program, a full apology for all, on the road to potential reparations?
Well, it's so interesting because these reports are all collected, assembled, and made available through the Special Inspector General on Afghanistan's reporting and previously the Special Inspector General on Iraq through Amnesty International reports, through REPRIEVE reports that you mentioned earlier in the program. And yet the mainstream media very seldom even parts the curtain slightly to let the U.S. public become more aware of what the consequences of United States war-making have been or of who benefits. And I think we'd be mainly speaking of war profiteers and major corporations. So I actually think the task is education, 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 and to keep on pushing people in our communities to educate ourselves and then to try to build our strength by linking up with other like-minded groups who want to seek social change. I don't think that we'll get that education through the mainstream media, and so it becomes important to do kind of a grassroots initiatives of educating.
Kathy Kelly, that's certainly what we do at Project Censored over the last several decades, and we have covered these drone strikes, and we've covered the problems of the Orwellian language of humanitarian war, and we will continue to do so, and do so in concert and solidarity with you and your important work, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, online at www.vcnv.org. Kathy Kelly, thank you for joining us on the Project Censored show today. You've been tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. The Project Censored Show airs on over 20 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Ritualized alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out the reach, all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers in.